President Obama fielded questions during his final press conference of the year on Friday that included how the U.S. should respond to Russian hacking and the Syrian civil war. We will talk about these issues and others with a foreign policy expert and welcome your thoughts and questions. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. What kind of action do you hope the U.S. takes involving Russia? What questions or concerns do you have about the U.S. response to the Syrian civil war? How about these increasing tensions with China after China seized a U.S. drone? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Bruce Gentleson, a professor of public policy and political science at Duke University. His areas of expertise include U.S. foreign policy globally and in particular in the Middle East. He was also the former senior advisor to the director of policy planning at the State Department between 2009 and 2011. Good morning. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Well, we have so many issues to talk about, and I want to kind of set each of them up with a clip from President Obama's end of the year news conference. Here, President Obama is discussing Russian involvement with the cyber attack in the U.S. election.
Not much happens in Russia without Vladimir Putin. This is a pretty hierarchical operation. Last I checked, there's not a lot of debate and democratic deliberation, particularly when it comes to policies directed at the United States. We have said, and I will confirm, that this happened at the highest levels of the Russian government. And I will let you make that determination as to whether there are high-level Russian officials who go off rogue and decide to tamper with the U.S. election process without Vladimir Putin knowing about it.
So, Professor Gentleson, is President Obama right there? Is this something that was likely done with Vladimir Putin's blessing?
Well, I think it appears to be the case. The intelligence community gave its rating of high confidence, which is the, you know, highest rating of truthness that the intelligence community gives. There may be a congressional investigation, but, you know, Putin himself and the Russians have somewhat acknowledged they tried to do this. You know, why they did it, we're still sorting out, and what its effect was, we don't really know. But for Americans, you know, the notion, I mean, if we had a movie and we had a Russian spy landing in the United States, you know, like in the Cold War and trying to affect the election where you could actually see it, our minds would be blown. And cyber is a little more, you know, subtle and out there in cyberspace. But this is a big, big deal because it means that whether it's Russia or others who are hackers out there, it's something that our political system that we cherish is going to have to really work to prevent in the future, as well as figure out what happened this time.
As you mentioned, there likely will be some investigations. A bipartisan group of senators, including Senator John McCain, urged Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell in a letter on Sunday to create a new select committee on cyber attacks to investigate possible Russian interference in the American election. I guess what's your reaction to this show of bipartisanship and whether something an investigation like this might take place?
Well, it's great to see bipartisanship in the Congress. And this was Senator McCain, who, you know, is widely respected, and Senator Schumer of New York, who's going to be the new leader of the Democrats in the Senate. We need this kind of bipartisanship on this issue and others. It's important that a special committee be selected. Frankly, Senator McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate's original response was, yeah, we'll investigate, but we'll kind of have our existing committees do it. And that really appeared a chance to bury it. And for a Congress that spent quite a bit of time and quite a bit of money investigating things like Benghazi, it seems appropriate that we have a serious investigation of this, because it's much more of a threat to our own system and our national security than some of the things they spend a lot of time on. So it needs to be a select committee, needs to be staffed and resourced, and then it needs to live up to the expectation of the American people that it'll give, you know, an analysis that may have political ramifications but is not politically motivated.
Incoming White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus was on one of the Sunday shows, and he suggested that President-elect Donald Trump will accept that Russia is behind the hacking of the DNC. If the U.S. intelligence community drafts a report that has that consensus agreement, so I guess Priebus is still saying prove it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's always a tension with intelligence information, how much you can put out there, and how much you don't want to put out there because it'll reveal your sources that could be, you know, you want to be make sure they're useful for other things you want to do. That's probably, in this world of relative things, progress on for President-elect Trump, who's been running around saying, never happened, it's just sour grapes. And I think, you know, Putin's motivation clearly was to disrupt our system, to show he could do things to us that, in his mind, counter our efforts to support democracy and human rights in his country. And it does appear that he was trying to hurt Hillary Clinton and help Donald Trump. How much it did in voters' minds, you know, we don't know. But, you know, he's been pretty, you know, stepping right up to the line of explicitly saying it, but definitely implying that. And so I think we... You know, the evidence is getting stronger and stronger. President Obama has promised a report prior to January 20th. I think they will put as much out there as they can. But like a lot of things we try to prove, you know, it's hard to have the exact smoking gun, but still plenty of evidence that would lead, I think, open-minded and objective people to conclude that this likely happened.
Russia has challenged the U.S. to prove it, too, calling it indecent to make such accusations, and some electors are calling for intelligence briefings. What is the difficulty with making the intelligence public?
Well, we're on a short timeline. The electors are voting today.
Right.
And then I think to have, 538 people, you know, every time, you know, when I've been in government, I have to go through this, you know, extensive security clearance. And how much you can tell to this mass of people is actually more limited than if they go through this process and, let's say, by January 18th, issue a report that they've had time to look at left, right, and sideways about what could go out there. When the Russians call something indecent, you know, I have to say, if you want to use the word indecent, it really fits what Russia's helping Bashar Assad do in Syria, what Russia's been doing in Ukraine. So, you know, we need to find ways to work with Russia. There's no question about it. But I don't give much credence to accusations on their part about others doing things that are indecent.
Yeah. You don't see any this issue or any others causing the electors to elect someone different today, do you?
I don't think so. I will say that, you know, there's been a lot of debate about what the electors' responsibility is. And it's kind of like a lot of parts of the Constitution. If you go back to Alexander Hamilton's original vision, you know, in the founding and in the Federalist Papers, the reason we have an electoral college was really to put a buffer between, you know, the people and final decisions in a representative democracy. And so the notion that the electors have some ability to inject their own judgment is consistent with this system. We have not had much precedent of it over the years, so, you know, it'd be a hard thing to make a giant jump now. So I don't think it's going to happen, but if it were to happen, any arguments about being unconstitutional, I think, aren't that strong because it's a huge constitutional debate. But my sense is we'll see a few Republicans do that today. Some of them have been saying they've been getting death threats if they do it. But I think the vote will be, it will elect Donald Trump president.
Yeah. So why, if these cyber attack allegations that Russia was behind it prove true, why would President Putin want Donald Trump elected president?
It's a really good question. And so, you know, there are a couple of, theories that are going around. One is he's made statements during the election that, that in terms of Russia's interest in Syria, basically said, let's let them keep Bashar Assad in power, no matter how brutal they do it, and maybe find ways to work together on ISIS. Russians haven't, they said they were there about ISIS. They haven't really done that. There's been a sense that he is less committed to NATO. And more than at any time during the Cold War, Russia has been flexing some muscles in various northern countries of NATO and elsewhere. He's nominated a Secretary of State who has extensive business interests with Russia. And has said that we should, lift sanctions, even though that's been one pressure point that has been causing Putin problems. So there's a sense that, that there is, a relationship there to work together. And so, his inclination and statements he made during the campaign, some people call them pro-Russia. I've said that they're sort of deferring to Russia more than I think many Americans think is in our interest. So he may want, and he really had both grudges against Hillary Clinton personally, and her positions were putting more pressure on Russia, on Syria, on Ukraine. So, there's a sense that a Trump policy would be more in Putin's interest, as Putin calculated it.
Let's take a call from Boyd in St. Francis. Hi, Boyd.
Good morning, Julie. It's been a while, and hello to your guest. A couple things. This is a very straightforward question. If Trump still then is confirmed and as our president, will to many feel that this has made Vladimir Putin maybe officially the most powerful man in the world, if he isn't already? And the second point, since Trump had won his presidency, it seems certain politicians that can be perceived as far right have really stepped up their game. People look at Geert Wilders and Marine Le Pen. But I've also heard there could be things brewing in Poland and Slovakia and also Greece. With that being said, many of these want to pull out of the European Union. Would that benefit Russia if that would happen? And I'll take my questions off the air. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Boyd.
Yeah, thanks, Boyd. Very good questions. On the first one, I wouldn't go so far. The Russians, the old expression of a Potemkin village that the Russians used to do back in the days of the Tsars, which was put up the front of a village and nothing behind it. Putin's strength is really built on a Potemkin village. The Russian economy had a negative growth rate last year, and it has one so far based on the numbers for this year, partly the sanctions, partly the collapse of oil markets. When human rights protesters protest at home, it's no big deal to Putin. But when truck drivers shut down the roads around Moscow, as they have, that's a big deal. And I also think in Syria, he's going to find that while he's kept Assad in power, it's going to be a burden for Russia going forward. So I don't think this is a period where Russia is ascendant in any, broadly global sustainable way. Your second point, I think, is absolutely right. I think that what we're seeing across Western democracies are three things that are contributing to, a real sense of swirl and instability. One is the sense of being left out by globalization. That was the Brexit vote. Many people that voted for Donald Trump, that's their sense, that they've been losers, not winners, from the global economy. And you see that in many parts of Europe as well. Secondly, frankly, this cultural anxiety. We will be a majority-minority country within a decade or two. And that has created a lot of anxiety in the country. And I think one has to understand that and try to work with it. And you see the same thing in Europe, partly the Syrian refugee flow, but partly the legacies of their colonial period and migrations. And then the third has been terrorism and a sense of personal insecurity. So every single country in Europe, the ones that Boyd mentioned, even a country like Denmark that we think of as a nice Scandinavian social democracy, the second largest party in their legislature is an anti-immigrant party. So all of our democracies have serious issues to deal with. The United States, even if Hillary Clinton had won, we would have had to still deal with these. And it is a really complicated and great concern period for democracy here and all over the Western world.
Dora tweeted, more sanctions are needed in terms of actions the U.S. should take toward Russia. And President Obama has said that the U.S. will take some sort of action against Russia, but what kind of action is possible?
Yeah, I think sometimes we turn to sanctions when we don't know what else to do or don't want to do other things. We've sanctioned Russia a lot. It's not clear how much more there is to sanction there. There are a few steps we could take, and I think that we probably should impose them. And frankly, if Donald Trump threatens them in some ways, it's even more, it's a stronger message than Hillary Clinton, because Putin may not expect them from Trump. Whether or not he'll do it, I have my doubts, but it could be helpful. I think reaffirming our commitment to NATO, which is, a central commitment to the United States, is also important to show Putin that we're serious about that. And trying to lead the world to, denounce him and take action against him for his war crimes in Syria. All of those things are important. Sanctions is a part of it. But sometimes, like with North Korea, we talk about sanctions, but there's not a lot of their economy that we're engaged with. And so in practical terms, we got to figure out where there's leverage and where it's more of a symbolic action.
You made mention of it, but President-elect Trump has named ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson as his Secretary of State pick. What are your thoughts on this pick, especially in terms of our future relationship with Russia?
It's very interesting that somehow there's this notion that you can take people who have no government experience and give them very high positions in government, right? We don't think that about the corporate world. We don't say somebody who's never been in business should be the CEO of a major corporation. We don't think about that of, the entertainment world or, running the Green Bay Packers, we don't pull people out. So the notion that he can just step in that experience, I've got real concerns about that, as to Russia, he has strong economic interests. He sees the world like a person out of the oil industry. And I don't know him, and I don't want to, make aspersions to his personal character that he somehow would manipulate foreign policy just to help the company that he worked on. But that is his worldview. And I think it further contributes to Trump's worldview in ways that if you want to strike a deal with Russia, which Trump says he's good at, you shouldn't go into it with the other side thinking that you and your top advisors, are too inclined to give them what they want.
Yeah. I mean, before we close out on this segment, and we will talk about what's happening in Syria and what's happening with China as we go along this hour, I did want to ask you about another statement that President Obama made at the press conference. He said close to 30% of Republicans when polled did not think that this was a big deal, that perhaps Russia hacked the DNC email, that it was not considered a big deal. How big a deal do you think it is?
It's really of concern. It's taking politics to sort of the ends justify the means. And coming from a political party that has been the party that has supposedly been the most hawkish on Russia, criticized Democrats, sometimes fairly, a lot of times unfairly, for not being hawkish enough. I think it leads to fake news and we're believing what we want to believe, and at some point people need to say, even if they said, I know it happened, it may have influenced the election, but I still think Trump would have won anyway. I'd actually be more comfortable with that than just this, because it's somehow, it's anti-Trump, I have to deny that it was real. That's not a good mindset for us to both try to come together as a country and deal with this world in which not just Russia, not just China, but a lot of countries are out there challenging us in lots of ways. And we've got to have good analysis and agree on, what facts are, and then dispute things that are a little blurrier.
Yeah. And on the other hand, Jesse in Shell Lake says, the U.S. gets involved with other countries' elections. We can't have a do as I say, not do as I do mentality. What's your response to that?
I understand his point. When we do that, we often say we're doing it for higher principles and in the name of the people of the country who want democracy and human rights. But, you know, if we're honest with ourselves, Jesse's right. We used the CIA to overthrow governments during the Cold War that had won elections in Guatemala in the 1950s and in Iran in the 1950s as two examples, to intervene in elections. And so, you know, our scorecard is not clean. And I think that it's something we need to take into account. I think it's okay when we advocate what we believe are universal principles, but not when we go in and manipulate. But even given that, I think we have something to be really concerned about what Russia did. So more honest with ourselves would help our credibility. And I think in that sense, I agree with that part of his point.
We're going to take a short pause. When we come back, we will talk about the latest from Syria and what happens next with Syria. Welcome your thoughts about that at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. President Obama, during his end of the year press conference on Friday, was asked about that, and he said that it is something that that haunts him, that that, you know, civilians are being harmed so in this civil war. We'll talk more about that coming up. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about some foreign policy issues in the news with our guest, Bruce Gentleson, who is a professor of public policy and political science at Duke University. His areas of expertise include U.S. foreign policy. He's talking with us about some of the issues that President Obama addressed during his end-of-the-year news conference on Friday. Here's what President Obama had to say about Syria.
Responsibility for this brutality lies in one place alone, with the Assad regime and its allies, Russia and Iran. And this blood and these atrocities are on their hands.
So, Professor Gentleson, this is Assad's atrocity, not President Obama's?
Oh, Assad committed the atrocities, no question about it. But I think, as someone who served in the Obama administration in the first term, this is one of the greatest failures of President Obama's foreign policy. And, it pains him. I know friends and colleagues that are still in the administration, it pains them. I just think they've been wrong. I think in some respects they learned the lessons of the Iraq War too much. I had opposed the Iraq War, President Obama had. And the notion of the United States trying to occupy a country and send in massive military forces, it would have been wrong for Syria. But there were other options available, and there have been all the way through. It's getting harder and harder now. And in some respects, he really didn't, he was so haunted by that they didn't pursue other options. I mean, an example, in 2012, after the presidential election, Hillary Clinton was still Secretary of State, and David Petraeus was head of the CIA. And they then proposed that we increase some of our military assistance to the opposition at the same time that we try to negotiate and find some common ground with the Russians to pressure Assad. It was rejected at the time. There's no guarantees, but I think the only way you could have, pressured the Russians and the Syrians was a combination of coercion and diplomacy. And the world is paying the consequences. Syria's conflict has not only been a humanitarian disaster for the Syrian people, there would not be an ISIS the way that there is if they did not have that huge areas of Syria terrain to establish themselves. And the massive refugee flow, as we were talking about before, has been one of the factors destabilizing Europe. So the issues didn't stay inside Syria. And so it was a combination of interests and our basic values that have been violated. And it's just gotten more tragic over time.
Yeah. When the president was asked if he felt any personal or moral responsibility at the end of his presidency for the carnage of Aleppo, the president said, "I always feel responsible." You said this is probably the biggest foreign policy disaster of the Obama administration. What kind of effect could Syria have on Obama's legacy?
think it hurts it because it gets at core values. And I respect the president for being honest about that. I think his, you know, I do think his integrity and seriousness is something that one of the reasons he's leaving office with higher approval rates than any president in a long, long time. Not just U.S. responsibility, though. You know, many countries in the region for whom the threats are even greater because they're in their neighborhood have kind of, you know, played their own games with their own groups, you know, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and so they have not come together even among themselves, let alone with us. So there's lots of responsibility to go around. And this is not something the United States should have done for those countries. But I think we still are, we're in a position to be the ones to basically tell people, look, this is what we'll do. This is what you all need to do. And we need to, you know, even if none of us get our first choice here, let's come together on a second choice and give the Syrian people a chance. And I've been out of government, but I've spent the last 2 years sort of a behind-the-scenes role trying to work on Syria, on the diplomacy in Geneva and places. And, you know, I also feel the pain and know many Syrian Americans who, you know, who've lost family, and we've all seen those videos coming out. And you can't just say in the world there's no solution to these things. There really has to be an effort to not – you can't perfectly solve them, but you can avoid, you know, the worst – of the war crimes that we've been seeing.
1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org if you'd like to talk about U.S. Policy regarding Syria. Saeed in Green Bay is with us now. Hi, Saeed.
Good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call. I think Syria is just but one manifestation of a greater issue with the Obama foreign policy. He has insufficient respect and support for democracy around the world. He went to Cairo University, the American University in Cairo, and gave a moving speech about freedom and how he would support democratic movements in the Middle East. Immediately thereafter, the greatest democracy movement in Iran in 2009 came to fruition in the form of the Green Movement, and he completely abandoned them. Our last ambassador to Syria went to Aleppo, stood with the demonstrators, and said Assad must go, as did he and our Secretary of State at the time. At that point, only 2,000 Syrians had died. Hundreds of thousands have died, and we did nothing. We incited this and then didn't support them.
Yeah. So how was the U.S. supposed to make sure Assad would go, Professor Gentelson?
Well, I think on the point of Assad, I think the strategy was a mix of supporting of coercion and diplomacy, providing sufficient support to the opposition, and there were, you know, an incredible alphabet soup of groups there, trying the best we could to work with the moderates so that Assad could see he couldn't win a military victory, and the Russians would see that the cost to them of trying to maintain Assad open-ended were too high, and then come together and negotiate an agreement where Assad would leave. It's not that you'd go straight to elections. That would sort of be a fantasy, but you'd have something that would be an inclusive way of governing and a lot of aid coming from all around the world to rebuild the country. But the broader point, you know, I think ignores the support that President Obama gave to the Arab Spring in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Libya, a little bit, but not as much as I would like, in Bahrain. And in fact, he's been criticized for why didn't we keep Mubarak in power? Why didn't we keep the murderer Gaddafi in power? So, you know, I share your caller's concerns about Syria, but I think the broader indictment just doesn't fit with the Obama policies. They supported the Arab Spring in ways that many people said, leave these guys in power. You know, they may be bad guys, but they're friendly to us. And again, it's not just the U.S.'s fault that the Arab Spring went wrong, but it is fair to criticize the Obama policy in Syria, I think less so as this broad sweeping notion of not supporting democracy.
Yeah, in the news conference, President Obama said, my first priority has to be what is the right thing to do for America, in reference to his decision to not commit ground troops to Syria. So maybe Talk some about whether the American people wanted U.S. ground troops or more forceful military action in another country's civil war.
Yeah, and that's exactly where, as we were saying before, his notion that there were two options only, do what Bush did in Iraq or kind of do what he's been doing in Syria. And none of this was about ground troops. It was about, military assistance, training, some special ops, as some people say, not boots on the ground, but some Nikes on the ground, which we actually have had, finally, in small numbers. And I think that those were the options that really should have been explored. Because, as your caller said before, in 2011, 2012, the killings and the refugees in Syria were there, but really the numbers start to go up dramatically in 2013 and 14. And, there was what I've sort of called, and I'm writing this, sort of the Vegas dilemma here. We had this commercial on American TV for a long time that what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
Right.
But what happens inside states doesn't stay inside states. And thus what's happened inside Syria, helped create ISIS, flows of refugees. And that's where there were options, none of them perfect, each with their risks, but I think with fewer risks and more potential upside than what the administration has done.
Let's go to Phil in Crystal Lake, Illinois now. Hi, Phil.
Hi, thanks. I just was remembering that when Obama wanted to bomb Syria after the chemical weapons thing, he went to the Congress, and the Congress said no. And I think that never is mentioned. It's always just mentioned that Obama didn't want to do anything. But I think he wanted to do that.
Did he want to do that? Did Congress say, I don't remember, Professor Gentelson.
So it's an interesting question. There was a sequence there. When the revelations in this was, I think, August, September 2013, the revelations came out that Assad had been using chemical weapons, and the president had said this is a red line, something that if you cross it, there'll be real consequences.
Yeah.
Public opinion polls originally showed the public was willing to support some military action. And the public only shifted when the president started to say that he had doubts. He didn't need Congress's permission to do what many people at the time advocated, which was simply to, for the next 36 hours, hit Syrian military bases, hit their intelligence installations. No claims that you're going to totally reverse the conflict, but you're going to show that when you do things like use chemical weapons, there's a price to be paid. And that loss of credibility really did hurt the president. And when presidents say something, the other side of this is President Trump running around saying things about Taiwan, which is really destabilizing things in Asia. When presidents say something, it's the Navy says loose lips sink ships. Well, presidential statements have huge consequences. And so he could have done that on a limited basis, including consistent with the Constitution and Commander-in-Chief, without having to go to Congress for that. If you commit American troops on an open-ended basis, that's different than you should have congressional approval.
Last week, President-elect Trump said the U.S. would create safe zones in Syria under his administration, and that the Gulf states there would pay for them. However, Obama told reporters that idea presented a continued challenge because safe zones require protection by ground forces, something the Syrian government and its backers in Russia and Iran would be unlikely to agree to. Your thoughts on safe zones in Syria?
The irony is that was one of Secretary Clinton's positions in the campaign that Trump repeatedly criticized her for. And he just talked about, making the desert glow and beating ISIS and forgetting about it. So it's a little ironic. Maybe it's a positive sign that he's getting more pragmatic than he has been up to this point. I think there are ways to do it. I think the ground troops would come not from the U.S., but they would have, like I was saying before, from the coalition, from Turkey, from others in the region, from the opposition. And there's a way to do that that could be in consultation with the Russians. The Russians, they've kept Assad in power, but they are, holding a losing hand. If they try to keep him in power on an open-ended basis for the next couple of years, good luck with that. Even if they take Aleppo, which they are, there'll be guerrilla warfare, there'll be terrorism. So there is a way to do that that I think is doable that could help with the refugee flow and maybe start to send a signal. But it was one of Hillary Clinton's positions that Donald Trump, you know, told her that she was absolutely wrong on. So let's see whether he means what he says when it comes to actually making policy.
Yeah. Can you, the news this morning, evacuations, according to one UN official anyway, resumed in East Aleppo this weekend as part of a ceasefire agreement. Can you walk us briefly through the latest developments in Syria and what you expect is going to happen?
Sure. I think, you know, with all the mixed news coming out, the thing for listeners to look for is whether the Russians and Assad allow the UN and the Red Cross and the Red Crescent in its form in the Muslim world to come in and supervise. Because I think without that, there have already been stories of people evacuating and disappearing, not getting to where they're supposed to be going to a genuine safe zone. And there's no reason, if there's a commitment to the humanitarian concern, to not let the UN and the Red Cross and others, you know, take this over. And so you can understand, and there are tens of thousands of people still in Aleppo. It was the largest city in Syria. You can understand why people are leery about leaving. I mean, some can feel like people did during the Nazi period, so get on this train out of Poland and we'll protect you. And, you know, they ended up in concentration camps. So that's the thing to watch for. Is the UN allowed to really supervise this? If not, it's really a feint and not the real thing.
Yeah. So what do you predict next for Syria?
It's just such an awful road ahead. I mean, even if we ended our time together in this show and found out there was an agreement, rebuilding a country that's been as devastated, you know, over 50% of the pre-war population has either fled, killed, or been internally displaced. Whatever economy was there before has been destroyed. You know, cities like Aleppo, how do you rebuild them? My fear is that even if ISIS was eliminated, there would be, you know, a group that might be, if Al-Qaeda was the 1.0 and ISIS the 2.0, we'd have the 3.0. And it's all the more reason why ending the war and starting a political transition process has been so crucial. The longer you wait, the harder it is. And as we were saying before, it doesn't just stay inside Syria. Israelis are worried about things flowing over their border. Countries like Jordan and Lebanon, already with their own problems, have been destabilized by the flow of refugees and terrorism. And, you know, it makes the Middle East, which has always been an unstable place, that much more unstable. And whether we like it or not, it affects our interests and our safety.
We're way past our break time, and when we come back, we will move on to one other U.S. foreign policy issue, and that is our relationship with China. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Bruce Gentleson. He's a professor of public policy and political science at Duke University. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are following up on three issues that were discussed in President Obama's end-of-the-year news conference on Friday. Three big foreign policy issues in the news. We talked about U.S. foreign policy with regard to Russia and the Syrian civil war, and now China. On Friday, it was reported that China had captured a U.S. drone in the South China Sea, adding to tensions with the U.S. This came after a phone conversation between President-elect Trump and the president of Taiwan. President Obama addressed the strain during Friday's news conference.
But understand, for China, the issue of Taiwan is as important as anything on their docket. The idea of one China is at the heart of their conception as a nation. And so if you are going to upend this understanding, you have to have thought through what are the consequences are, because the Chinese will not treat that the way they'll treat some other issues. They won't even treat it the way they treat issues around the South China Sea, where we've had a lot of tensions. This goes to the core of how they see themselves. Their reaction on this issue could end up being very significant.
We are talking about the reaction of China with Bruce Gentleson, professor of public policy and political science at Duke University. His areas of expertise include U.S. foreign policy. Over the weekend, China said it would return a U.S. naval drone that it seized last week in the South China Sea. President-elect Donald Trump tweeted on Saturday, "We should tell China that we don't want the drone they stole back. Let them keep it." As of Sunday afternoon, China had yet to respond. But what kind of action? Talk some about the seizure of this drone and how significant this is, Professor Gentleson.
Sure. I mean, the thing that set it off was President-elect Trump's phone call with the president of Taiwan. And talk about a bipartisan foreign policy. You know, Nixon and Reagan, Clinton and Obama. The one China policy has been for almost 50 years American foreign policy. And to just sort of cast that off with a, you know, phone call and a tweet like he did, not only for China, but it's a very worrying sign about how foreign policy is going to be conducted in a Trump administration. And since then, China's reaction initially to the call was actually somewhat restrained. And when Trump upped the ante with more tweets about it, you know, they got more firm in their responses. And then this incident happens. And it's not to excuse what they did, but it demonstrates what happens when you say, hey, let's just disrupt things and see what comes out on the other end. We also seem to be settling this diplomatically. I have no idea why we would say keep it, as if, you know, somehow there's teenage spiteful game being played here. What we don't know, and I think maybe the intelligence community does, is whether this was something ordered from Beijing as a way of, you know, retaliating for what Trump did, or whether it was a, you know, overactive naval officer in the region. The latter doesn't dismiss it, but it helps you understand what it means. So, you know, our relationship with China, for all the differences we've had, we've worked together on climate change. We've worked together somewhat on North Korea. And you just don't want to sort of, you know, just go disrupting these relations with, you know, a power that's emerging as the second largest economy in the world. We have leverage over them. They have leverage over us. And I think it's in our interest to, you know, be realistic about the issues where we have conflicting interests, but try to work them through, you know, in ways that are diplomatic and not just, you know, getting in your face.
Yeah. So help us understand why President-elect Trump would want to antagonize China by accepting this phone call with the Taiwanese president and or telling China to keep the drone.
Yeah, so one theory is he says, well, you know, he said this in one of his tweets, if Taiwan's important to them, let's pressure them on that, you know, to get what we want on our issues. And, you know, it's sort of a strategy of bargaining and leverage that says, and I think people can relate to this in their own work lives or personal lives, you know, if I really hit you hard on something important to you, you're going to give me what I want. But I think we all know that sometimes if you hit somebody really hard on something really dear to them, like President Obama was saying about Taiwan, which is about their core sovereignty, not just a transactional issue, it antagonizes the person or country you're dealing with, gets their back up, and is counterproductive. And Trump may have been able to do that with small subcontractors building cabinets for his casinos because he had total leverage over them. But you don't do that with countries. They demonstrate that it doesn't work. And so if that's the way he thinks you negotiate to get better deals, you know, for the supposed man of the art of the deal, I think he fails to see the difference between the business world and dealing with countries.
We have calls on this topic, too. Jim in Wanakee is with us now. Hi, Jim.
Well, hi. Thanks for the program. I just adding on to what the professor was saying about the relationship with China. My concern is about our economic ties and our interdependence, you know, with China, and how this might be a threat. You know, this recent strain about the drone and so forth, in terms of a lot of our corporations make things in China. And Trump has talked about, or at least some of his staff have talked about, you know, tariffs, get more companies in the United States, you know, pulling our contracts out of China. And so the other concern is that as this situation deteriorates, if it does, is there a chance that we know that Russia isn't going to be our buddy for very long, if they've ever been. Is there a chance that Russia and China might go against the United States? That's my anxiety for the future. Could the guest please talk about that?
Mm-hmm.
Sure, good points and good questions. On the last point, you know, Russia and China are cooperating on some issues, but I don't foresee China thinking its interests are so sufficiently linked to Russia's for them to get totally in the same camp. And so everybody's playing everybody else off, but I don't think that's going to happen in the world. But the economic points are exactly right. I mean, you know, I actually think, and this is not China, it's our own tax and domestic policies, we need to create more incentives for companies, you know, to create jobs within the United States and not export them as much. And there are ways to do that that people talk about who know those issues, you know, far better than I do. You know, and I think with China, we do need to improve the terms of trade and exchange with them. But the notion of a 35% tariff on Chinese goods, which Trump said during the campaign, your caller's right. Well, okay, you know, a lot of those are parts for your iPhone or other things that are manufactured. And so, you know, American inflation will go up, the prices to American consumers will go up. And so there you're doing something to hit the other guy, and you're actually hurting yourself too. And, you know, the Chinese might say, okay, you want to do that? You know, see how much you like the consequences as well. So it's not a smart strategy. It's more of a, you know, I'm angry, so I'm just gonna lash out at you.
Yeah. So, what do you expect a President Trump to do in terms of the one China policy or our relations with China?
You know, I would hope he would come back to the one China policy and work within that. I think one of the better nominations he's made is the governor of Iowa for ambassador to China. In stark contrast with the person he's nominated to be ambassador to Israel, which I think is a terrible appointment. So it'll be, and you know, whether or not his advisors, you know, maybe Rex Tillerson will see some benefits in pursuing business with China, but in a more moderate way. But I think this, you know, the biggest issue here is not just China, but is this foreign policy by tweet. And, you know, that's just not the way to do things at, you know, 11 o'clock at night or 3 in the morning or 7 in the morning. You know, you need to have some strategy and process to what you do. And, you know, whether it's China or Russia or some other country he decides to tweet on, it doesn't bode well.
Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity to talk with you and your listeners.
Bruce Gentleson is a professor of public policy and political science at Duke University. His areas of expertise include U.S. foreign policy. He was also former senior advisor to the director of policy planning at the State Department between 2009 and 2011. Thanks very much to Brianne Chasso for producing this program. Thank you for listening. Coming up tomorrow at this time, it's On Your Money. Financial planner Kevin McKinley will be in with information and advice and will answer your personal finance questions. That's On Your Money tomorrow at this time. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.